college in 68, everybody was more social-minded about what you can do for the world, that kind of thing. You know, that as compared to now, students are like, how much do I make?
Yeah.
When they get out of the college, it's like,
what's your retirement plan?
Yeah, retirement, yeah. Do you have good medical? I remember coming back to Buffalo, going back down in June or the end of May to graduate from the University of Georgia.
Uh-huh.
And then saying goodbye to everybody, you know, all your, you know, going off to wherever. And that's basically when you didn't see anybody again, everybody kind of scattered.
Uh-huh.
You know, so we had a, and then going back up to Buffalo and then spending about a week in Buffalo before going to Washington, which was still in June. I remember it was in June.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Good.
I remember it was in June, going to Washington for some orientation. Then I remember going to Harper's Ferry for a couple of days and train, some kind of training. And then before we knew it, we were on a plane.
Yeah.
And we're going, most was excited, you know, because we got to land in Alaska. And we got to go outside the plane for a second. Then we spent overnight in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
It was like,
yeah, that first overnight in Tokyo.
It's like first of all,
wow.
Never been anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I was never, at that point, I was never anywhere. I mean, the first I went was Georgia. I always stayed in New York State. The first west I ever went was to Michigan, to Kalamazoo, because my grandmother was there.
Uh-huh.
And went to Canada a lot. That was different.
That's different. I mean, that's just across the river. Yeah.
I mean,
go to Fort Erie for Chinese food.
Yeah. Or the striptease now they got.
Oh, no.
Well, Niagara Falls is big with that.
Yeah.
And just going other, you know, into northern Canada, but not that far away. But
go to Toronto or something.
Yeah, and also for camping and stuff. So going to Georgia was the first.
So you can get your fill of black flies.
Yeah. One time.
Never mind. But anyway,
so
you're
in training. Then from there, then we went then right to the Philippines.
Oh, you went.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Because you went to Los Baños for your real training.
Yeah. So that was right after the 4th of July, and I remember being there. It had to be over a month. And
In the 4th of July in 68, I was in the southern island of Mindanao.
Mm-hmm.
In the Philippines, is that big one?
Way south.
Northern city of Cagayan de Oro, because I remember. There they called the 4th of July Phil-Am Friendship Day. And we were involved in a big Phil-Am friendship ceremonies and basketball games and stuff like that.
Yeah, because it was always a colony or a...
Yeah, well, you know, they were given liberation on July 4th of 1946.
All right.
So it's their Independence Day, but it's kind of not an Independence Day.
It's still following American... So we're going there, we're studying tropical agriculture. I was always shocked. To me, when I was at the University of Philippines, I remember the what they call a professor, was teaching us about animal husbandry.
Mm-hmm.
It was the most beautiful football I've ever seen. She'd walk around with white dresses and a white umbrella. I'm going, she looks like about, you know, like everybody looks so young. You know, she's probably older, but like in 20s, she has her doctorate. I thought that was kind of...
She definitely was older, but you wouldn't have known.
Yeah. So that to me was shocking. It was more shocking stuff. Then we went from there, then we went into, it was in August, and then we went to, flew to Saigon. All right, Saigon, and then our group, I remember flying into Saigon too, because at that time my ears, I wasn't used to traveling a lot by the planes, and you didn't know how to handle...
Pop.
Yeah, so I remember having my ears plugged for about 2 days, plus you get real hot, and it was, you know, almost at the end of rainy, it was in the middle of rainy season, it was August.
Yeah.
I heard hot and humidity, but it was okay because I got used to Georgia.
That's right.
Georgia, you just had the
you
same
You came
problem.
From there, yeah.
And so it was a gradual kind of...
It was a little more, but it was different, but it was okay.
Yeah. So I remember that, and then from there we went to our group, whatever our group was, maybe 12 people. Well, the group that we went to Los Baños included people going to Laos. I remember a few out of that group who were killed right after that, like about a year later. I remember they were in a jeep, three of them, and they hit a mine or something like that. They got blown away. I remember a bunch of people got killed. Matter of fact, at that point, I think they were going to pull out of Laos after they got killed, and this was in 69. So anyways, our group that was going to Vietnam, we went to Nha Trang on the coast for language study.
Who came with you? Do you remember?
I remember it was Vic Savano.
Uh-huh.
I remember it was a Japanese girl who was a Japanese American, didn't know anything about Japanese. She didn't last too long. Mm-hmm. Then there was a girl from the Philippines, Sabrina something or other.
Fajardo.
Is that her? Yeah.
Sabina Fajardo?
Could be, yeah. She's from the Philippines. She was good. She was an agriculturist.
Did you know a guy named Steve Swift?
Yeah, Swift. He was right before me. He wasn't in my group.
Yeah.
But Steve Swift, I guess he's out on the West Coast now somewhere.
He and Sabina are married.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Matter of fact, probably. I probably remember that, but I can't remember. You know how time goes? I can't.
And they live in Honolulu.
Ha! Huh.
And I interviewed them last April.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, so she was a very thin, smallish girl, yeah, Sabina. Yeah. Yeah. She was, but I remember being about my age, 50. Mm-hmm. You know. But she came over from the Philippines. I remember doing the night before we left the Philippines, because she was going to change her mind, because all of a sudden a guy that she knew came out of the, you know, like, oh, this guy's interested, now you're going overseas. Because I remember we were doing that stupid dance, that thing with
the... Oh, yes. The tinkling.
Yeah. I remember doing that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But the Philippines always impressed me, because they gave us, I guess I remember, gave us $6 a day per diem. Mm-hmm. You couldn't spend $6 a day. No matter what you did, you couldn't spend it on food, beer, anything. It was impossible. it was because everything was so cheap.
Right.
So anyway, yeah, with Sabrina, I'm trying to remember. Then it was a Japanese guy. He only lasted about a year or two, and he got tossed out of the country. It wasn't Frank Nagaro, but it was another guy. I have pictures of him. I got him. He was an extreme left winger, a Japanese guy. He, in that group, who else? Oh, there's one guy that couldn't stand, who came and then, after a year, quit. Mm-hmm. But he came out of a religious family. His father was a minister. He came back, and then he quit IBS, couldn't take it. And then the next thing I know, he's working in the IBS main office in Washington. I can't think of his name. Oh, Chuck Finger. Now we're talking about
Brian. Wow.
Yeah, I think he always, I said, well, how do you like that? He quits and then he comes back. Right? Mm. After quitting, after going through the training, things like that burn me up, is that you come through the training, you don't do your commitment. See, that's also the background, is my background coming out of the blue collar type thing, is that you always fulfill what you're doing. You always, you know, if you go to work, you make sure you work on time. You know, if you do
whatever you do. You put in your 8 hours and you do a good job.
You don't, you say, I ain't going to do this and be hard headed. You don't do that. Mm-hmm. I remember him leaving, but he was in that group, and there was a couple of teachers.
You can't remember his name.
No, I probably have it written somewhere. If he come out of a religious family, I remember he kind of grew up in India with his family being back, whatever it is, some kind of evangelist of some sort. And was this it? Oh, good.
Oh, good. Let me pause this. Let me turn this on again.
Oh, okay.
There, it's back on.
All right, so going through the language, I'm trying to remember who was in those classes. I actually have a picture downstairs because we're at a chicken barbecue and all the faces are in it. Mm. Well, actually, I do have a picture of us somebody took, everybody in the class, which I actually could show you before you go, if you want to, because it would be spur my memory, too. I don't look at those pictures a lot. But I was going through the language class. I remember we had the teacher... was a young guy, nervous young Vietnamese guy who spoke North Vietnamese. Right?
Uh-huh.
We're going to work in the South, which is a whole different tonal accents. Mm-hmm. So I remember studying the Vietnamese and understanding it a bit, you know, but I'm not a great scholar when it comes to sitting and learning, particularly languages. Even though now I think I can learn languages pretty good. I think
you were bilingual at home, so you must have had
some. No, we weren't. No, I'm not saying that. No, we didn't speak Italian at home because my grandfather...
What about Polish?
No, I didn't. My mother did. With my grandmother, but never with us.
Oh, so the kids were not included in those conversations?
Yeah.
We were not encouraged.
Well, I would hear a blah, 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 Johnny, blah, 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 your name, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so no, it's the languages were like...
Same way with my folks.
Well, languages were foreign to me.
Same way with my folks for Swedish.
Yeah.
They'd be talking away back and forth with not with each other, but with other folks in the family. Maybe. They knew Swedish.
Yeah.
They never used it. Yeah. Yeah. The only thing I learned was a part of one little prayer. That's
it. They just didn't use it in the house.
They just didn't, and they didn't really encourage any kind of curiosity on our part.
So languages were, even though I should... always want to do as a mental exercise, I've been saying this for the past year, is to learn Spanish. I studied Spanish in high school, but never did well with that.
Right.
But here, because Spanish is convenient. That this is a mental exercise. I want to learn Spanish. I think I could do it pretty quickly.
Why not? You get reinforcement.
Yeah, in my office, our community educators, ones that do nutrition work, teaching our Spanish. Mm. So I was learning the language to an extent, but not really learning the language until I was out in the field.
Yeah, well, that's the best.
Because once I went out in the field, all right, so from there.
Then you got the right tone. You were under pressure to learn.
Yeah.
You learned the language that you had to have.
Plus, a rural population that they're limited language-wise. And a lot of it, so I learned a lot of agricultural words.
Yeah, you learned the technical jargon that you had to
have. I learned the language more so that even to now I have a tough time looking at Vietnamese. I could sort of some of the words, looking at it and understand it, but if I'm on the subway train or somewhere, I hear the Vietnamese talk, I know what they're talking about. Because I could I'm like, I was illiterate when it comes to writing, but a language, but can speak it. Even though I forget a lot of words, I have to read.
I do that with Tagalog. I mean, yeah. I can hear Filipinos talking, and I know exactly what they're saying. And I just kind of like listen in on a subway or...
Yeah.
I don't turn to them and answer.
No,
it's tacky.
They're talking about it because it's basically street talk.
They're saying, hey, what's your kid doing? Or what are you going to get the grocery tomorrow?
Yeah, the other day, we went to a lot of Vietnamese restaurants in Chinatown, so we go to get the soup, the pho.
Yeah.
And there's always a conversation going on there.
I had pho with Steve and Sabina.
Oh, yeah?
in Honolulu.
Yeah. Pho is tremendous. Pho is near. They got some great pho spots. $4 for a giant bowl.
Yeah.
Tremendous. So anyways, not learning the language to work out in the field. But see, I went and I replaced, first of all, with IVS, the other thing too is that, meaning that when the IVS says, oh, we're accepted, you have a trip, did you like to go to Laos or Vietnam or where? Send me where you need me. Yeah, that's my lazy, my kind of attitude. So to Vietnam, which is fine, if everybody else didn't think it was fine. Vietnam, isn't there a war going on there? Yeah, don't you know that's what all this is going on? Of course, later on right now, people say, oh, you're in Vietnam, was the war on then? The war was always on there.
Well,
There's always a war there. So he's out there. Replaced a guy named Jeff. See, I can't think of his last name. I'm thinking of the way the Vietnamese used to call him Om Jeff, and then they used to make jokes about him. they taught me about his habits and things he's doing and stuff. And
so it was nice joking.
It's strange. He from there got his way into USAID, right?
Yeah, well, a lot of people did.
Yeah, which is always bugged me too.
Yeah, but a lot of people did.
Yeah, because they used IVS as a little stepping stone, which...
Once they were there and they saw what the
I always liked a lot of them went into... even now I experience that working with Cornell, all the years I've been working with Extension, that a lot of people that came through our program that were hired for summers and stuff, it's a stepping stone, you find out what's going on, and they all went on to do good things.
Yeah.
You know, like very good jobs. Throughout the city, a lot of the green organizations' heads now are come through our program, or Regine's work with me, which is nice. But I remember replacing him way out Wahao area, which is way out. I mean, to get there, you had to take a ferry boat and then another 20 kilometers on a dirt road to get to this little village. There's no America, so I had to learn language. But to me, I was in heaven.
Yeah.
I was the only person around, and they really didn't, after a while, they didn't really...
Yeah, you said that.
You
said in your form you was like 30 kilometers from anybody.
Yeah.
You're the first American in 30 kilometers.
Yeah.
And this is 68, so why were you so safe? Because it was Wahao?
Yeah.
Or give you a choice here, or maybe it's going to be all the above, or was the Tet Offensive so disastrous for the Viet Cong that they were in retreat for a while when you arrived?
Yeah, at that point, the closest they got in the area was across the river during Tet.
Uh-huh.
Not very close. They avoided the Wahao area. Because I think Chowd Up up the road. Chowd Up got nailed. Lum Swin, which is nearby, slightly. I think the pinpoint was Chowd Up because it was more on the border, on the river border, and they avoided.
So it was really Wahao. More the Wahao.
Yeah. So it was
protecting you.
Pretty safe there. There were a few times that I remember driving, because I had a little 50cc Honda, a little motorcycle,
because
I daily go out and visit farmers and things. I remember a couple times when I used to take a route going somewhere, occasionally I would be told to go back.
Okay.
Yeah, that does usually told to go back. saying it's not too safe out there today. You know, it was getting out of the Wahao area a bit.
Yeah, yeah. Who would tell you that?
Farmers on the road. Mm-hmm. Come up, yeah.
Wahao farmers or Vietnamese?
Yeah, Vietnamese. Well, Vietnamese, Wahao. Well,
let's say Wahao or not Wahao.
Yeah, they were Wahao.
They were Wahao.
But they were not in the center of Wahao.
Right, so they were more on the fringe.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was at the Wahao, pretty known, you know, people. Because I'm always around. I was always,
yeah.
I do sure. Here in the city, because I'm always out and about. Is uh-huh. how you do uh-huh. that kind of work. Uh-huh. Is you got to
yeah.
be, you can't be sitting down, you got to be out. So that was, I mean, I think only once that I had to evacuate the area. That was forewarned ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. Again, the Wahao were looking
yeah,
over you.
Yeah, I had to leave and went to Long Spoon for about 3 days. And then mm-hmm. there was a slight battle down the road from where I was, and that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know they're encroaching, because each day someone says, they're 30 kilometers, there's some battle going on, the VC are moving in each night. And then I remember coming back after it was over with and actually go and look at this little battlefield where thing took place, where they had VC had holes and those the helicopters that used to shoot that
yeah
that blasted the hell out of these holes, so your bodies blowing up inside these holes. That was kind of interesting.
Shoot.
So I think that was closest that came to any
yeah
any problem. It was the war was at its full height in 68. Mm-hmm. But in that area things were normal, and that's why
you could be there.
Yeah, and also that's why things were getting done. Meaning that mm-hmm. I stepped into the project that this Jeff did, which was working with 4-H, and oddly enough, I still work with 4-H, but it was called 4-T there, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
With farmers and their kids and doing chicken projects and pig projects, meaning that we bring in these nice kind of chickens. I remember we used to fly them in, some kind of a Japanese of Godo, these variety,
mm-hmm.
to raise chickens to show that you can produce more meat with the chickens. But my goal is, when I got this, what they got to do is they got to feed them better,
rather than having them free range.
Yeah, free yeah. range. Well, you know, free range chicken is valuable now in the city. Yeah. It's a valuable chicken. But there, they don't only feed the chickens just leftover rice and that kind of stuff. So
at best.
Yeah, so my thing was let them improve their feed them a little bit more. So I would try things like just grow this little patch of sorghum. I was always getting seeds from the Philippines, some from Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
I used to bug people with those Taiwanese that were doing, they had a little experiment station. And, Mr. T, he's called Mr. T, was that his name, Chinese guy? He used to always visit. He was a Taiwanese Chinese guy, but he was a fun guy.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows where to go to fun, go visit me or go visit some of the other people. So I was always in contact
with him. He was IBS or not?
No, he was a Taiwanese agriculturist, come down his development work from Taiwan.
Oh, okay, all right.
Yeah, but he was there to have fun too.
Yeah.
Where's the woman? Yeah. But so I got kind of close to him there, so I get different seeds. And I remember, you get some sorghum seed that can grow in that climate and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So my thing was that improve the nutrition, and you can, even though sorghum was one way of doing it, because the Vietnamese didn't eat sorghum.
Right.
So
they wouldn't say, we give this to chickens? No, we should give it to people.
Yeah, yeah. So they gave it to chickens. I said, this is what you want to do. One time yeah. I brought in, I had them do like small plot, not to use a lot of marrow. These are peasant farmers, and they didn't have large pieces of land,
right.
except for when they're doing the rice. All right, when they're doing the floating rice, then they used to have high rain, they could, so many hectares that was theirs to harvest. But when you're just a little peasant on a patch of land,
mm-hmm.
the best you can do farming-wise during dry season is what you can get irrigated. Or if you're close to the river, you can dip water out. So I used to have them do like a small, nothing more than the size of this room. I had them do field corn. I got some field corn seed that was
thin.
I remember going back to them, and after they're growing it, and oh great, the field. So this is what now you could feed this to your pigs or chickens, it'll be more protein, or even feed it to the fish. Instead of just,
crap.
I used to have a crapper right over the pond.
So yeah.
Take a dump mm-hmm. and the fish uh-huh. would eat that.
Yeah.
I remember the corn, they said, that corn really grew great. It was big and the ears are big, but boy, did it taste terrible. It's field corn.
Yeah, right.
They couldn't see feeding it to the animals.
Yeah. Why not?
Because it's corn. Their sweet corn is a main staple there. You know, sweet corn
okay.
is right.
Yeah.
Field corn, they never had there before. Field corn, there wasn't
they couldn't get over the fact that...
Yeah, you feed that to
animals, that it was a corn for...
Yeah,
animals.
Yeah, yeah.
There's corn for people, of course.
They go, because they go, belong, big ears on that. Yeah. I go, yeah, but it's field corn. But they said, oh, boy, you had to cook that thing down to eat it and stuff. And whether, they fed it or not. So my idea of going there is to work with those programs, was to make those animal programs good, supposedly to be working with these kids, but in reality there was no real youth groups. It was the farmers themselves who, uh-huh. who knowing, oh, they're going to do, there's money from Save the Children to buy us some chickens, because we got some money from Save the Children Foundation.
Okay.
Oh yeah, we'll form a 4-H club. Meanwhile, it was a network of
the kid would give the chicken to the father, and then
yeah, they had their little projects, you know, and when I would come out there, sometimes they'd go, oh, here's a kid, this is their, you know, even though it was their project, but
yeah.
It didn't matter. To me, it didn't matter, because I was more interested in getting, my thing was getting new varieties and stuff there.
Right.
Whether it be animals, or it would be seeds and things. So I think that evolved a bit, but then noticing that, well, these farmers really work close together as families work close together. Like this farmer here, this farmer down the world, they're all related. They can work together, right? The
mm-hmm.
ones outside the family, tough to work together. Because I noticed that all the 4-H groups was basically one family and their relatives, all right, down his farm. And I said, Jesus. So that's
for the whole extended
thing. So that's what Jeff was doing the whole time. He was just doing this and also bringing things, giving, because which is, since then, I was always against handout programs.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I get mad at you, say it a lot, too. Is handout programs don't do it. You got to do things from, you got to have involvement to get things done. I mean, you got to have, development means all the players are in action, and it's not, and if there's monies or handouts, then that group should look for the money or handout, not come in there like, here you are, right away, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is still how we do programs, which how I've always run extension programs in the city when doing, projects that are, gee, we need soil. They don't really need soil. If you work hard, you can make some compost and da-da-da-da.
Yeah, handouts are only good for
humanitarian
things, for refugees in desperate
food,
need.
Yeah, for need. Someone's got to be fed and stuff. So that probably
but not that. For people who have something ongoing.
Yeah, so that always bugged me when I was there. But I did notice that the farmers worked together pretty good as families. And also at the same time, was like the Erie Institute with the new varieties of rices.
Mm-hmm.
At that time it was IR-8 was a new one, IR-8.
Yeah, and then 5.
Yeah, IR-5 came in, and then there was
22?
Yeah, I was there through 8, 5, and 22.
Yeah.
So and then the farmers...
I know that because I was too.
what varieties are now, but the farmers...
There's a 23, there's all sorts of things.
So farmers, they wanted... I don't know how to try to think about how they knew about those new varieties of rice. I'm not certain.
Oh, really?
I'm trying to think. How did
they had
know?
Some inside track, huh?
Yeah, they knew. I'm trying to think, did they see a demonstration? Could have been demonstration by the Taiwanese at this experiment station down the road that one farmer went
uh-huh.
to. But they said, we hear about these new rices that produce 10 times as much, but you do it during dry season. Right. Remember, they had the floating rices, which was their main staple.
Right.
And they always, at that point, they always paid back. Like,
is that a sticky rice, floating?
Yes, it was the preferred. It wasn't the sticky rice.
Okay.
It was a shorter grain, preferred by. I used to call it a red rice, because the hull kind of red, but it was their preferred thing that they like to eat.
Yeah.
Right.
I've never seen that.
What, the floating?
Yeah.
Oh, the floating was tremendous, because this was. Floodplains.
Right, yeah.
So you have waters go up as high as the room here, and then
mm-hmm.
a lot of houses are all on stilts.
Yeah.
Because then you get flooded in. And then there's the dry season comes, and so January, February, the waters 6 feet, and you just have all this rice laying there, and you
more regular
fresh.
Patty.
Yeah.
So with the...
floating rice, yeah.
This is almost not part of the interview, but I think it'll be a short question, so
mm-hmm.
I won't pause. Did the floating rice actually just only float, or did the roots make it down to the ground?
Oh, no, it started off in the ground.
It did start to the ground.
You always
okay.
seeded before the floods come.
Okay.
Then it seeded itself, and it grew following the height of the water.
Ah, it would grow as much as the water would go.
Yeah, and then when the water starts receding a bit, it forms its head and flower, and then form the seed and stuff. And then eventually the water retreats. And
when would they harvest? Would they harvest out of a boat?
Sometimes, yes, depending on areas, you would
uh-huh.
harvest it out of the boat. Most cases, you wait until the water completely subsided. And those
soils
dried
up. And
you
just have a tangle of roots and weeds?
Yeah,
and
yes
leaves?
And no, but it was organized. Tangle.
Really?
Yeah. A lot of it, well, it was not, it was...
I was thinking, it was really hard to harvest there.
Not really.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to remember how exactly. You just go through the field, and you cut and tie, and cut and tie. And
really?
It took a lot of time, a lot of labor. But anyways, they were, that was a traditional rice growing, and then dry season they always do a couple plots of vegetables. So I got so I got involved further with them at the end. I always with the new seeds. I want them to try new things. I remember bringing in new type of soybeans, some other type of this, and do and also doing the usual grinding type of things. So you need certain fertilizers, and this is certain pest spray with this, this kind of thing.
A little acidity.
Yeah. But they were they were limited on their growing areas because they're limited on water. So you had to be very careful about what they grew, because if they didn't get success with that, that meant they lost money. Or they didn't have food. So, but then they, but then some, one of them knew about this rice thing. So I'm going, yeah, we, that's what we worked on in the Philippines, these new varieties. They just understand it gets 10 times the yield. So we did a small spot. So I shipped it. We did a small spot. We got the rice seed. They started a little, you know, like, what you call it, a Yale mound, which was a little seed bed. We start the seeds, start the transplants. And one of the farmers was able to, he had an old pump. He was able to pull some water, all right, to irrigate this one paddy.
And they did a small demonstration.
And it did so well.
Yeah.
I mean, they amazing amount of yield on it.
Yeah.
I mean, they would say 10 times. But then those problems came about is that then the landlord, right? The,
well, did they like the, first did they like the taste of it?
No, 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 no. This rice, sell it. Yeah, yeah, see, to me it was...
This is a for export.
Yeah, this is what they sold, because they said, oh, we like their flow, because it's natural customs. That, so that
it probably did taste better.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the Uri rice, the early stuff, did taste like shit.
Yeah, yeah.
But it didn't taste really bad.
Yeah, it was, but it was good enough to sell.
Yeah.
To send to market and stuff like that, plus 10 times yield in a small area like that.
Absolutely.
This also brought them extra income in during their off-season.
But you were saying the landlord, too.
Well, yeah. See, they were able to use more. Their usual areas that they grow vegetables, they have to deal with hand watering all the time. So there's a certain amount they can only do. Here, they're able to expand out. They're able to get some water to fill a paddy, which means you don't have to water every day. I mean, there's only so much you could do, you know, as far as irrigating your crops, because they didn't have. Everything was done with the over the buckets, over the water, you know, over the shoulders. And so then the landlords, I remember, got involved in this. He more so got involved because the farmers, I remember the following season, wanted more land to use. But then the landlords, I went, still 10%. 10%, so therefore the landlord was making more out of it. So they had to kind of bargain down. Wait a minute, now when we used to get 100 bushels. Now we gave you 10 bushels, now we're getting 1,000 bushels, now we got to give you 100? That's a lot for the same land that we're only, it's like raising the double, making the rent more. So that was kind of a little issue there. So that had to get resolved. So
I
these
thought,
people
I thought were, the Wahao owned their own land.
The well, yes.
It was through the religious corporation.
No, there was. I remember this lady who owned. This was. She was a Wahao. She owned a lot of land.
She really did. They had private land owners.
Yeah, yeah. And these are the peasant farmers that we worked with. The ones that lived in the lousy shack.
Yeah,
right on the road, just about.
Right.
You know, it's getting, because they were just peasants. They weren't the more owner guys, which were basically the owner ones.
Mm-hmm.
Were a lot of the ones that I worked with the 4-H programs with.
Okay.
See, they were smarter too. You know, like they had their own nice house.
Uh-huh.
You know, they had their own little burial background, you know, the grave thing with the cement stuff. And,
mm-hmm.
And so they were also smart, but we started working more closely with those ones really in need. And those were those peasant farmers.
Yeah.
That were just scratching by, you know, like when you go there to eat, this is what, have lunch with them. And I learned to use chopsticks very good, because you're competing for that one little small patty fish with some seaweed and a little bit of rice, right? Which was, you know.
So scraping the bottom of the rice pot to get that
crispy
rice at the bottom.
Yeah. And the same thing, their cooking was always in the back on a pot with fire on the ground kind of thing. So these are real peasants, I guess the word peasant, but they're also very good farmers, you know, and they saw like, well, look at this rice, we can do it. But their need was to have pumps.
Oh, we got tape, I'm sorry.
But their need was to have irrigation pumps and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing that they can work together through families. So then I partnered up with another guy, this Vic Sabano, who came over with my class. And he was a little older, he just got out of the Army.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still trying to find where the hell he is these days.
Oh, well, I'll come up while you talk.
Oh, you may have it?
I might, we'll see. Come on.
His Savannah, S-V-A-N-O-E.
Yeah.
So anyway, but he was a Nitschke type of a guy, all right? He was a philosopher, Swedish background kind of thing. He was
With a name like Savano?
Yeah, because you think it would be Italian, but yeah. It's S-V-A-N-O, because he was blonde, and he was bald, but he used to show pictures of his sisters, all beautiful blondes.
Huh.
Is he on there? S-V-A-N-O-L.
Oh, S-V. Yeah. Oh, okay. I thought it was S-A-V.
Yeah, that's, it's a fake out.
Yeah.
S-V-A-N-O-E.
You know, I didn't get anything. Here, let me pause for just a second. Okay, I got it back on.
But anyways, he was in childhood. His background was philosophy in college. And IVS, see, this is the thing I was neat about IVS is that he was already in Vietnam with the Army. Came back and wanted to do his thing for life. He was a philosopher type guy who was always preaching this, not religion. Because Nietzsche was his major philosophy guy he liked. But he was liked to sit and talk, and he learned the language very good.
Uh-huh.
But he was in Child Up, primarily wondering what to do as a volunteer. He was going to do work with community development, this and that, and whatever. And I used to go visit him a lot, just to go visit. You know, I had to go up to get my mail. It was at a McGee station up there.
Uh-huh.
Or, you know, the APO, we used to get our stuff.
Okay, good morning. It is morning, still.
Still
it's
morning.
About 6 minutes after 10. It's Saturday morning, the 4th of January. I am in Brooklyn with John Amoroso, and we've just had a cup of coffee. He had more than I. Coffee plus the eggs.
I gotta get my cholesterol.
Yeah.
Correct cholesterol fix.
Gotta get those egg yolks in there. But, John was in Vietnam, and he was there from 68 through 70. Came in after Tet, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would be interesting, I think, to follow up on, you know, life in Vietnam after Tet, especially for an agriculturist like you were.
Mm-hmm.
What IVS was like under Danny Whitfield, who I had a chance to meet in Southern Illinois. And maybe what Hugh Menke was like. I don't know if Hugh had taken over as director when you were still there.
Whitfield just was leaving.
Mm-hmm.
No, Menke was a little later. There was another guy, which I can't think of his name.
Okay.
Somebody, he's out
kind
west.
Kind of an acting.
Yeah, yeah, there was a person that him and his wife, I can't think of their names. They live in, I think, Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
Something on the West Coast, so you wouldn't have run into him then.
No, that's Mark's turf.
Yeah.
I'll give him the West Coast, or the Left Coast. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so we might get into that. And you were in a Oahu area and all that kind of stuff, and I find those interesting people too. But to really start, take you back to your own beginnings,
mm-hmm.
just like we have with everybody, pretty soon I'm going to basically shut up, except for maybe occasionally breaking in to clarify something.
Yeah.
And you know, kind of steer things along. But I'll let you go off and tell me first something about your origins, where you were born, who your parents were, not just the names of your parents, but what they did for a living and, you know, how they ran the household,
yeah.
and things about your family and how you were brought up and what were those important influences on your life that made you the young Amoroso lad who wanted to go off into this strange thing and make a huge pile of money every month.
Still the mission statement is that you still don't make a lot of money.
Still don't make a lot of money, right. But, you know, basically now I can just listen to you. So please tell me.
All right, let's see now. I primarily come out of a, what you call, working class families. Like, when I grew up, born on the west side of Buffalo, which is primarily at that point, it was mostly Italians.
Uh-huh. Still is.
It still is. It's more, my aunt still lives in in the house that my grandfather bought in 1909. And also my background is, I guess we call us like one of the old wave immigrants. Like my grandfather came over in the 1800s, and my mother's mother also came over the same time period, right around 1900.
Okay.
Right, so that's, again, too, it's another completely different story. My grandfather come from Italy,
Yeah.
Right, and that's the Amoroso side, and that's right. Where we grew up with my grandfather in the house until we moved out to the suburbs. But my mother's Polish. So my grandmother, the other grandmother, who primarily was my mother primarily raised in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Uh-huh. I don't know how that all gets together. But I was same thing, working class, speaking two languages, that kind of thing. Except, I mean, on the Polish side, but on the Italian side, you know, we didn't speak any Italian because it's that old line. My grandfather, you know, never spoke Italian in the
house. So he didn't pass that on.
No, we didn't have.
So you got Polish from the maternal side.
Yeah, because my mother still spoke Polish.
Spoke a little bit of that along with English in the house.
Yeah. But still, the old line type immigrants, still working class. As compared to this neighborhood here, where if you go up the street here, some of the young people speak Italian because they're from, you know, their parents came over or their grandparents came over, like say in the 1930s, 40s.
Uh-huh.
So you have a different generation. Like mine are very old types.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that way it's...
more fully integrated.
Yeah. I guess growing up, there was nothing in the background to, you know, right? When you come out of a working class background, the whole thing is you have to work, you have to get a paycheck kind of thing.
Yeah.
But there's also the strive of, you know, my parents, particularly my father, about education, because my father never graduated high school, naturally.
Right.
During that time period, and he grew up during the... He was actually an adult during the Depression, so it's a matter of education is very, you know, very important.
Yeah.
But then again, what type of education? I don't have really farm background, even though coming from Buffalo, Western New York, is very rural to an extent.
Well.
Yeah, it's and,
you not know, the always, west side.
Yeah, no, it's not. But I had the background from my grandfather, when he came from Italy.
Uh-huh.
Was primarily a farmer there. One of these hill type guys that, uh-huh. So we always had large gardens in Buffalo, and even when we moved out of Kenmore, my mother always had a garden that was big, it was like maybe 100 feet by 30, I mean big size.
You moved out to Kenmore?
Yeah, well, town of Tonawanda. Okay. I always call it Kenmore because of the mailing address.
Oh,
even Kenmore is like 1 square mile.
Yeah, it's just a little teeny thing.
But at that time, the mailing addresses were all Kenmore.
Oh,
it was only two zips, or two, you know, before the head zips.
Yeah, before the head zips, yeah.
Now it's different. Now you don't have to put down Kenmore and stuff, but they didn't have post offices out in that end. So I was always had the outdoor background. So in high school, the same thing. Is interested in sciences and stuff, but never really volunteer programs, didn't know anything about. And that growing up, you join organizations,
mm-hmm.
you do various things, but... can't ever recall. So I was volunteering for the church, like on paper drives, things like that. Mainly it was not volunteering because you're doing your duty volunteering, but it was volunteering because it was a lot of fun on paper drives.
Yeah,
sure was. Throwing the papers around.
Yeah.
So you never had the volunteer.
Clothes drives, things like that. Yeah.
So then going to school to study agriculture was, see, everything is kind of hit and miss with me. I originally wanted to go to Cornell and study like wildlife management. That's the only thing I could think of in terms of, you know, like, I'm a little businessman, you know, I'm not interested in office work and stuff like that, or studying stuff. That wasn't me, I was outdoor guy.
Yeah.
So wildlife management, but I couldn't get into Cornell, oddly enough, because they had to give preference to students that came off of farms. This is back in 62.
Oh, for that particular program.
Yeah, which now you go to Cornell, most of the students that are studying agriculture, which the numbers are down, most of them don't even come off of farms. At that time period, I couldn't get into the school there because I didn't come off of a farm. And most of the students now, no one has the rural background because of the decline in farms. But back then, you had a lot of small dairy farms.
Maybe they still have that preference, but there are no students coming off the farm
right.
to study agriculture.
Yeah.
They want to be MBA and managers.
Yeah, that's right. They're not studying it. And ones that do actually come off of farms, they're going to Cornell now, I do get a little... They get a little preference,
mm-hmm.
Particularly acceptance in undergraduate, particularly acceptance in graduate programs. But then again, they know exactly what they want to do, too.
Yeah.
So I didn't get accepted to Cornell. So I go, let me try it. Plus, being out of working class, didn't have a choice of a lot of schools. It had to be somewhere cheap.
Yeah.
So it had to be
cheap
the state system, SUNY system. Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's Alfred has a soil.
Was it SUNY already?
No, they didn't. They didn't call it that.
Okay.
It was just one of the states. At that time, it was called Alfred Tech. Now it's Alfred College.
Yeah.
Get into the SUNY system. So I go, gee, they have a program in soil conservation. I go, what? Sounds all right, you know. So I applied to Alfred, got accepted there in agronomy. Not general agriculture, but agronomy. But at that point, in order to go through their program, if you didn't come off a farm, see, this is another change. Nowadays,
doesn't matter. Well,
doesn't matter.
Yeah.
If you didn't come off a farm, you had to do some farm experience. So you go...
Not bad.
Yeah, so instead of going three quarters of school, you went 2 quarters, fall, winter, and then spring you worked on a farm, like starting from March until September you worked.
Oh, okay.
Right, so that first year, I remember 64, I worked on a dairy
farm. You were on a quarter system.
Yes, on a quarter system.
In New
Georgia
York.
Was still on a quarter system.
It still is.
University of Georgia? Is it?
Yeah.
I thought they went this semester, no?
We're transitioning.
Oh.
Yeah. Wow. It'll be not this coming next year, but the year after.
Hmm.
I mean, we're going through also. Pause. Anyway, enough about quarter systems. Well, I turned this back on again.
So, anyways, we said,
you were in Alfred. Okay.
Yeah, Alfred. Yeah, it was. And then too, it was even before it was the old Alfred. Where our classrooms,
right.
These old houses.
Really?
Yeah. And matter of fact, I think we were the second class to live in the new dorms that they had. This new kind of a brick building. Yes, compared to all these other houses. Well, since then, Alfred's completely changed.
Oh yeah.
Remember, like, even where. With the farm, the dairy farm where we used to run the cows across the road to get to pasture.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't dare get a cow across the road. I'm like, wow, this is where we used to stand and let the cows, and there'd be milk cars. I'm going, look
right.
at this road now. It's like really, really changed.
Yeah, so anyways, I've driven by.
Yeah, it's like, whoa, so big.
Yeah.
So anyways, work on a dairy farm, then go back to school.
Mm-hmm.
The following year, worked actually in Silver Creek, New York, where a grape growers cooperative.
Silver Creek, I don't know much.
It's near Fredonia area, so we're
along
the lake. Kind of nice.
Yeah.
So you got experience like in fruit and
uh-huh.
more vegetable things.
Uh-huh.
And then from there, after Alfred, now why did I transfer to the University of Georgia? It was just like, well, everybody's, well, it's 2 years, the school's done, what do we do now? Gee, let's go to, well, here's Georgia, let's see, Cornell, if you go to Cornell,
uh-huh.
apply to Cornell, they want you to put in an extra year. That's changed now.
Yeah.
Because they said now the credits are lined up where you can go from the 2-year school to Cornell and graduate in 4 years. So at the time, it was only Georgia and Tennessee.
That would accept you just...
Yeah, yeah. So they're applying to both, getting accepted to both. It took Georgia because a lot of the more people were going to Georgia from New York, like
uh-huh.
from Alfred. And then uh-huh. once getting down to Georgia, there was a lot of other from the other state schools, Farmingdale and Colesville, the other 2-year schools. So there was and actually right now working with Cooperative Extension, New York State, there's a lot of, that I run so all the time, there's a lot of extension agents. They went to Georgia. I go, really? I said, I mean, I could name, you know, there's like at least 7 or 8 extension agents that are
uh-huh.
working in New York State that have graduated from Georgia also. It's like,
hmm.
So it was a place to go. Plus, it was cheap, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember like playing at Alfred, we used to pay maybe $66 a quarter, and that was because of your family income.
Yeah.
coming out of the blue class family.
Oh, really? They prorated it.
Yeah, but I mean, at Alfred, but at Georgia, that wasn't permitted.
Uh-huh.
So I go, oh, geez, I got to pay out-of-state tuition, what was like maybe $140 a quarter. Like, whoa. I was able to work.
It's not that anymore.
During the summers,
mm-hmm.
make enough money to go to school, pay for rent down there, living somewhere, also have a car.
A car?
Yeah, because during the summers, when you come back, you'd work, come back to Buffalo for a couple summers and work in a factory, whatever you had a job. You just save enough money for it. Yeah, car, what? Pay $50 for a car. Insurance was minimal. And
mm-hmm.
Now it's nowhere like that.
No.
So anyways, getting back after at Georgia, and I'll see it at Alfred.
What years was this?
Cause okay, well, Alfred was...
when were you actually born then?
45.
Okay.
Makes me, whatever, 51?
51, 52, depending on the month. Yeah.
Yeah, so graduated high school 63.
Yeah.
And graduated from Alfred in
65.
In winter of 66, because I was on that B plan.
Oh,
I was
okay.
doing
all right, yes, yes, you had that.
So I was like
stuff.
One extra year, not behind, I want to say behind, it's like...
additional year for experience.
Yeah, because to get the experience, which was...
Yeah.
So I was looking, I enjoyed the agriculture experience. I knew that I was going to be always working in something like that, you know, agriculture field, whether it be... See, at that time at Alfred, too, we were looking at, oh, from here we can get a job working with one of the chemical companies and recommending pesticides, being a representative of the farm, which I thought was great. I said, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get to work out in the field, visit farms, and
mm-hmm.
they give you a car, and great. That's when those jobs existed. But see, that was at Alfred, you were thinking about it, when it shifted down to Georgia back in 66. Also, I think that's when you started getting the social consciousness,
mm-hmm.
meaning that I was never down south before.
Yeah.
Right? And being from the north,
mm-hmm.
and also being with Italian background, you know, you didn't intermingle with a lot of different people. of other races.
Or even some ethnic groups. I mean, yeah. I mean, in, from my observation of Buffalo, a lot of the Italian and Jewish neighborhoods are pretty much commingled. But yeah, they're different from the Polish neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, they're
here,
really
here in New York, Brooklyn, too, is that the Jewish and Italians are always pretty close, except this neighborhood is primarily Italian. And then yeah. there's some Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
But in other areas, Bensonhurst and Brooklyn, some other ones, too, you always have the Jewish and the Italian pretty close together.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So anyways, me going down to Georgia was like being thrown against a brick wall. You know, it's like, I don't, they really treat blacks like that. I couldn't believe it. It's like, I remember having, me and this one guy went down there. That's when I didn't know anybody. He was going from, we drove down there. He was coming from Alfred. He couldn't take it so much. I remember after one quarter, he shifted and went to the University of Colorado because he liked to ski. But wow. I remember we rented this little place, like a little apartment for whatever it was. And the owner of the house rented used to have a maid used to come in to clean up. It was mm-hmm. a black girl. I was like, and they go, yes, sir. You know, they talk like down south. I was shocked. I was like, major.
Well, some of it's just politeness.
Yeah, but just the whole, also the way blacks were down there.
Okay.
I'm used to northern blacks.
Yeah.
And the way it was a really shocker for me. And I think that started changing me from being a very conservative to almost becoming, not liberal, but really left-wing.
Really?
Oh, yeah, so left-wing down there actually got slightly involved even with SDS, Students for Democratic Society.
Really?
To an extent. I never officially signed up with them, but
uh-huh,
a lot of
uh-huh.
the friends and stuff were with that. So he got more involved in that, you know, and then also the anti-Vietnam movement at that point.
Right, right. Was it very hot at UGA?
Oh, yeah. We,
okay.
With SDS, we actually sponsored, we went to Atlanta. I remember going once to go march somewhere.
Yeah.
I remember
yeah.
marching for that. I remember on campus they had their first student rebellion, which was, I think, in 67. It had to do with women's rights. They took over a building.
Women's rights.
I remember being involved in that. Yeah. About
really?
Yeah, it started off at that time the girls had to wear dresses. this is
no.
true. And that was part of it. And they wanted to be able to wear slacks.
Yeah.
So that was just, you know, like you got to have fuel for a fire kind of thing. So that was just getting started. So I remember getting involved with that. I also remember at the same time while down there going once somewhere where we were going to lay down in front of buses. And this was about 60 miles from Athens. I can't remember the town. And I had to do something with busing and stuff like that. But I remember that day there was like a million state troopers there, but called it off. Thank God, because I would have been arrested probably, which would have hampered probably me going into IBS.
Maybe.
Yeah, because they used to do pretty close
yeah.
security checks and stuff like that.
Or at least the government for visa granting and things like that.
Yeah, maybe that. So then when I was down there, I mean, it really changed around. I think that mm-hmm. going to Georgia was, and I think it had to do just with going, you know, never going down south and looking at, this is the 60s.
Yeah. You know,
this is the south in the 60s, which is completely much different than now and stuff. This is like...
Well, very different than now,
in
yeah.
fact, yeah, I remember the... University of Georgia football team, that 1 year I was there, had the first black on the team. It wasn't first string, it was like a second string. It's, you know, like that kind of thing. So to me, that was real eye-waiting. So I think that studying agriculture was always interested in.
Yeah.
Which so I still am, obviously. That
yes, yes.
My you it's my
career. Still do it.
It's hard to be in, I live in New York City, but my background is field is agriculture.
Because uh-huh.
we've been doing, I came to the city in 76 to start a program with Cooperative Extension called the Urban Gardening Program.
Uh-huh.
It had federal funds.
Yeah, yeah.
You
know. You've described that to me.
So anyways, after being down there, and then when graduation time started coming up, right, to think about going to graduate school, that's what I was saying. I went to somewhere to take whatever test you take to go to graduate school,
yeah.
whatever that
or
is.
Or the GRE stuff.
See, whatever it is. Yeah, I can't remember. I remember driving somewhere,
uh-huh.
and I swear it was in the, where you're at. I swear it was down there. I remember going to that and taking those tests, but that time, deferments were going on for graduate school.
Uh-huh.
This is 68.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I probably would have went to graduate primarily to get out of, remember, I'm involved in anti-Vietnam stuff, to get out of getting drafted, one reason. Because uh-huh. at that point I had already gone for a physical in Atlanta.
Oh, you'd already been
oh, yeah,
for
they
a physical?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I was still in school. They got all the seniors and stuff. Uh-huh. I remember getting on a bus going to Atlanta, passing mm-hmm. the physical, naturally. But still deferred until graduation, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then couldn't go to graduate school because they weren't giving the deferments then. You had to have failed your physical and stuff. So the next step was, because of being involved in what you call social justice type things, the time period of the 60s, and also thinking, this is, to me it was great because it was I remember there was a group on campus, Young Americans for Freedom, which is, I remember once going to one of their, when I first went down in the 60s, going to one of their meetings, and look at these guys with the shirts and the ties.
These days, Newt would probably think they're liberals.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, we thought they were white, right-wing wackos.
To see
you know,
Nazi thing.
Yeah, you expect Nazi armbands on these guys.
But
the Republicans are now so right-wing that they would even consider those guys as kind of tepid moderates.
Never going to that meeting, going, whoa, this is really weird. But then
he's a wacko.
But then when I started getting involved in more of the social stuff, the social rights and stuff,
and the
civil rights movements, the anti-war stuff, some of the stuff on campus. It also opened up a whole new crowd of people.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a lot of fun.
Yeah. They're more fun than the guys with the ties.
Yes. A lot more fun, too. So it opened up a whole new thing. So at that point, I remember sitting in, saying, well, what am I going to do now? Is that you're going to get drafted and stuff like that? And then having the mindset thinking, well, this is, the volunteer type thing. I remember looking at Peace Corps. Right.
Yeah.
I applied to Peace Corps.
That was always an attractive option for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I remember applying to Peace Corps, I remember at the same time, too, that I remember writing a letter to the editor of Buffalo Evening News.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw that because I remember my father being really pissed off about me. I wrote a letter to him from school, protesting the war and saying that I could be getting, much rather work in agriculture for development instead of war, that kind of stuff.
Really?
I never saw the thing. But
did it make it into the...
Yeah. But I was down there then, so I never saw it. I don't know what they did.
Do you have any idea when it would have been published?
68, sometime in the spring.
Spring 68?
Yeah.
Do you ever look through the microfilm for that?
No, I should. Except it would take forever.
Yeah, I know it would. But maybe they got an index.
Yeah, because I remember finally, because the people at work is, work in a factory, but it needs all the papers, and here it is with my name on there. How many Amorosos in Buffalo? None. I remember saying something about, the usual rhetoric, turning the weapons into plowshares, whatever, whatever it's kind of nonsense that you, the stuff that's already, the student, the kind of stuff you put together, which is basically the things that other people said already.
you don't know when in the spring?
I had to be like, my guess is, April, May, maybe not even June, because I remember, so I remember that was there. So I'm applying for the Peace Corps.
Because I'm going to, of course, it's good that you didn't send it to, what was the other paper, the Courier?
Yeah, this is,
yeah,
because they're out of business.
Yeah, they're out of business.
Yeah, it was Buffalo,
they've got it indexed. They might index the names of letters to the editor people.
That'd
so I might just write them, and see if I can get a photocopy of the thing.
Because I never get
pass it on to you.
I think they just threw it away and usually.
They said, "Oh, my damn son here."
Yeah. Now I have a collection of. I got a box that's got of things we can get into the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
With this program, I'm getting the newspaper billions of times and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those you save, but I mean that one don't have.
Well,
I think they got mad because it's embarrassing that, look at you. What if he doesn't want to go into the army and service because you're in a bad situation?
Oh, yeah. And yeah, you're in with the quote-unquote hard hats.
Yeah.
And the first and second generation Americans.
Loyal.
Love the country.
You at the same time, as I recall, my father didn't serve in World War II. I never want to bring that because he worked... He was a welder, so he worked on building airplanes, defense.
Well, okay.
Plus, he had a first kid in 41. I was like, wait, look, you weren't even in World War II. So, everybody else I know was in World War II. Anyways, applied to the Peace Corps.
Yeah.
The Peace Corps took so damn long.
Yep.
Getting through their stuff, and I'm sitting this is in the last.
And you're biting your nails.
Yeah. What? Yeah. Yes and no. At that time, I was always kind of loose. I wasn't worried about it. I was always, at that time, you kind of live for the day kind of thing. You're not looking at many days down the road. You want the day to last as long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, people say, geez, I wish this was, no, I wish today would stay long because it's still today. And tomorrow's tomorrow. So I always had that kind of attitude. But I was sitting in one of the classes.
I still do.
Yeah. I hate to see tomorrow come too soon. This time of year when it starts getting dark earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, no, the day's over. Right? But anyways, so Peace Corps take a long time. I was sitting in one of the classrooms. And our classes at Georgia were small, maybe like 12 students. And what was the, I remember it was something in field crops.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it was, that one course I was taking that, last semester, or last quarter, I can't remember. I remember the professor, which I can't think of his name anymore either, too.
Oh, yeah.
He would get things. He'd go, I have this, I got something in the mail here. I don't know if anybody's interested. It was from IVS.
Yeah.
I go, oh, let me see that. I go, oh, they're looking for agriculturists and teachers. Yeah, he says, geez, they're looking for agriculturists and stuff. I go, gee. I say, oh, that's kind of interesting. So I applied to IVS, and they responded within a week's time.
Yeah.
I mean, they got back to me and sent out some other forms and stuff like that. And within a month's time, they were accepting me. It's like, whoa, that's really great. Because this was maybe like in March of 68. Remember when I joined their group, went over, we started with them right before 4th of July in June.
Yeah.
Was that group. And then they had to do security check, and that always takes a little bit. And mine, they had it took a little longer with
the SDS folks.
Maybe. I always thought about that, too, but my name was never, use my name with them.
Yeah.
I was always kind of smart too. Like, I don't put my name on things like this. This could be, I know you people are just the cause, but no, I'm not that serious. Not that serious.
Let me back up for just a second, just to make sure I've covered all the points. I mean, obviously from either your Italian side or the Polish side, I know you were Catholic.
No question about that.
How serious was the religion and that influence on you that might have predisposed you toward that kind of?
Well, it's funny because even though right now, basically I don't go to church. Right?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes my wife would go to church with the kids when my mother's here. Actually, they got to go to Easter Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral this past year because my neighbor
big time
volunteers at St. Patrick's. He's like a bodyguard for this Italian bodyguard for the. Not the Pope, the Cardinal, I guess. And he had these passes to go in, so it was like, great, here you are, in your city right near you is Joe DiMaggio and the mayor and all these, and the great mass.
St. Patrick's is like it.
So anyways, there's a lot of churches in there, but at that time, I always went to church, because you grew up in this thing. I remember going to church every day for Lent.
Mm.
My grandfather used to drag me, in Buffalo, 7 o'clock mass. I remember being cold and dark, and my grandfather dragging me down the street to go to church every day of Lent, which was fine. Didn't care. Yeah, I was like, but I always went to church, and it was funny is that when going down to Georgia in the spring, because I was still going to church, and Alfred going to Sunday Mass, going down there, it was very hard to find a Catholic church.
Oh, yeah.
Catholic church did not exist. You're going, what? Well, I found one, not too far. It was in Athens there. I don't know how, it wasn't really too far from where I was living. I remember going there, and I remember the priest, who was the head priest, whatever it is there, he was actually from Kenmore. and so I started doing volunteer stuff with him, actually. I used to do the last thing in the world. You know, I used to do a Bible class.
Really?
On Saturday mornings or something.
Jeez.
Or Sunday mornings, I would sit with a group of kids and we'd read, even though I didn't know anything about the Bible. You know, But it was, it's fun.
Yeah.
Actually, it's odd because that's probably the first teaching that I ever did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's primarily what I do now is like most of the time we call ourselves educators to an extent. You know, most of the time that's what I do all the time. I'm always teaching.
Yeah.
You know, always instructing something or other, informal type stuff. So I remember doing that. But I remember the priest saying that when he went down to Georgia, he looked at it as missionary work. I thought that was so funny. I said, yeah, there wasn't that many Catholics. And also, that was another chakra, too, is that was sitting in the church, there's a lot of blacks that were Catholics. Never occurred to me that black people were Catholic.
Yes, right. Because they're supposed to be Italians and Poles.
Yeah. they're supposed to be other group, not them. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So I stayed with him for that quarter, but then the next year when I came back, then we didn't. I think he left out or something like that, and then it sounds like I was going to church at that point. That's when I became left wing.
but it sounds as though that the religion was at least well drilled into you.
Oh yeah, that
it was sincere, and that you actually went beyond just attendance by helping out and volunteering.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the paper drives and things like that. So there's some of this volunteerism that's going in your life. It may not be to the same extent of other people, but it's there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't like where you're like I know that my kids here, when they grow up, I'll encourage them to volunteer to do various things.
Uh-huh.
When I grew up, we weren't really encouraged to volunteer because
right.
my parents never did that.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
right.
like that, the same
right.
thing.
But you're getting into it yourself.
Yeah.
In little ways.
Yeah, it's the same as like Emmanuel, like she got a certificate of achievements. She's a pretty performance excellence science fair, March 95. She did this because we encouraged her to do science projects. Well, yeah, when I was growing up, I was never encouraged to, you know, just get good marks and, well, we can get average marks. We can get good marks, but not that other group of people can get good marks all the time. So IVS, joining IVS, I remember.
Comes together with social conscience, a little bit of volunteerism,
the
draft, and
plus also that they're into agriculture. I mean, the whole thing with the agriculture.
And it's a job you can relate to.
And agricultural development always turned me on. Meaning, I always liked the concept of Peace Corps.
But
then now afterwards, I looked at Peace Corps as more of a social organization.
It is.
You know, like, oh, people go there to find themselves. And then they come back with troubles.
Yeah.
So that I like the idea IBS was primarily interested in technology, or people who had skills background, either in the teaching or in agriculture already.
Yeah.
Even though now it's changed, now you need more than that to get an IBS. You need, like, they've been working somewhere for 10 years already in a specific, more specific type of project, not just the general type thing.
Yeah, so my impression, you know, from just to tell you about all the people I've seen, I'll pause this because it's not relevant to our conversation right now. I put this back on now. I forget where the hell we were.
Yeah, talking about.
Because I was bullshitting, and I'm glad I paused it.
They talk about how I found out about IVS.
You said the instructor said, "Hey, what's
right,
this?" And
right,
hey,
right.
Anybody interested, sort of thing.
And I remember applying for that too.
Knowing that point, one week.
Knowing that at that point, I could go to graduate school, and also the draft.
Yeah,
a big
breathing down your neck.
Right, because I already went for the physical. And that knowing that this is really what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, in reality, even if the draft wasn't there, I would want to do it because coming up